Welcome to the Financial Literacy Bootcamp, where certified financial planner Dominique Henderson discusses financial topics in plain English for the investing public. Dominique is the owner and founder of DJH Capital Management, LLC, a fee-only registered investment advisory firm offering comprehensive financial planning and wealth management services to entrepreneurs. You can visit them on the web at www.djh-capital.com or on social media by the hashtag Financial Literacy Bootcamp. Now here's the host of the Financial Literacy Bootcamp, Dominique Henderson.
Welcome to the Financial Literacy Bootcamp. I'm your host, Dominique Henderson, and the Financial Literacy Bootcamp is designed to help the financial services industry to be more relevant, reliable, and respected to those we intend to serve. And we do that each week by describing financial topics in plain English for the investing public. And I have a very significant challenge today because I'm going to be really breaking down some financial topics today. Some big words that hopefully at the end of this, you'll know a little bit more about what they mean and things like that. So welcome to episode 54, How Do the Rich Really Get Rich. And I really wanted to kind of cover a topic I've covered in a previous podcast. I've mentioned several times on the podcast about The Aspirational Investor by Ashwin Chhabra, Taming the Markets to Achieve Your Life's Goal. He introduces some concepts in there that are probably not very common amongst investors. Maybe they are, maybe they're not. But what I really wanted to hone in on is what I would call the Cliff Notes version of the actual mechanism on how wealth is generated by the wealthy. And not just any wealthy, the Forbes 400 wealthy. So we're talking about some of the most wealthy individuals in the U.S. and the world, for that matter. So we'll dive right into that in just a second. But I wanted to kind of set some of that up just a little bit, because I think at the end of the day, this podcast, what I'm trying to do is bring information and knowledge that I've accumulated over going on 2 decades of doing this, and bring that to you for, you know, very actionable steps that you can take in your financial picture. And obviously, if you need more help than what you can provide yourself, then we're here for that type of resource. So here we go. The first term I want to talk about is systematic risk. And I apologize for bringing in such a big term that no one probably knows what it means, but I'm going to try to do my best to break that down and make it, let's call it very, very bite-sized for you. So there's this term called systematic risk, and all it really means is risk that is inherent to a system, thus the term systematic. So if you're kind of thinking about investing in the stock market, for instance, that's something that everybody is used to, whether you do it through your 401k or your E-Trade or Vanguard account or however you do it, everybody's pretty familiar with how you can invest in equities or stocks. Well, when you do that type of investing in equity markets, like an exchange-traded market like the S&P or something like that, or the U.S. markets, that has an inherent risk with investing. You can't diversify it away. It's what you get when you diversify or when you invest in the market. And so it's unavoidable, and it's really, really, I guess, designed or maybe defined, rather, as the uncertainty associated with investing in this type of system. Not unfamiliar or not uncommon is this type of risk with any type of system that you invest in. So say, for instance, you decide to invest in Bitcoin, where there's risk inherent to investing in that type of system, or commodities, or any type of system for that matter. The systematic risk is unavoidable because there's uncertainty with investing with any type of system, just about. And this is not to be confused with systemic risk. I've heard these terms be interchanged incorrectly, because systemic risk is a risk that is kind of defined as a collapsing risk, or something that can bring down a system. think about 2009 when the subprime mortgages basically almost took down the whole entire financial system, the whole global financial system. This is different than systematic risk. So we're just talking about systematic risk, which is inherent to the system you're investing in. So, you know, if people tell you, yeah, you need to lower your risk in the market, well, you can't lower, you know, your systematic risk, really. I mean, I guess technically you could by trying to isolate every type of risk there is, whether it be country risk or company risk or default risk or interest rate risk. You can try to isolate every single one of those and mitigate each individual risk, but it's so nearly impossible, which is the reason why you have risk in the first place that is called systematic risk. So hopefully that makes sense. So I wanted to talk about that because it has the its context for talking about the next type of risk, which is non-systematic risk or unsystematic risk. I like to call it concentrated risk. If you were reading Ashford's book, he would call it idiosyncratic risk. All of these are synonymous with the fact that it's a concentrated risk that you cannot, or that you can diversify away if you were to hold more than just one type of investment. So, for instance, let's say you were a real estate investor and all you had in your portfolio and all your assets were comprised of just real estate properties. Well, you are carrying non-systematic concentrated risk in real estate. The way you would change that or diversify that away is by bringing in other asset classes besides real estate. Say, for instance, maybe equity or fixed income or commodities or maybe private equity. You know, those are the ways that you would diversify your portfolio to contain less concentrated or non-systematic risk. Okay. But so keep that in mind. Now let's answer this real quick question before I go on further. Could you have both systematic and non-systematic risk in your, say, your 401k account? And the answer is yes, you could. How is that? Well, you're going to probably have anywhere from, I've seen less, but let's just say on average, you have somewhere between 10 to 12 different mutual funds that you can invest in your 401k plan. And those mutual funds are designed, at least they should be, designed to comprise just about 100% of what you can invest in, period. You know, the all asset classes across the globe, okay? So you've done a great job of eliminating non-systematic risk by having a variety, if not all 10 or 12 of those 401k choices in your plan. That's not to say that you go buy all 12 of those because there may be some overlap. But to have a good mix of those that represent at least as much of 100% part of the pie of all investments as you can. The thing to, I guess the other side of that would be, let's say that you were an Enron employee in the early 2000s. And as was documented by many news outlets, a lot of Enron employees had all their 401k assets tied up in Enron stock. Well, they were holding on to non-systematic risk in their portfolio, as well as systematic risk in their portfolio. So in the first example, although you have, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 or 10 mutual fund choices in your 401k, you'll still always have systematic risk because that's inherent to investing in the system of stocks and bonds and what have you. But you did a good job of diversifying out or getting out of your portfolio the non-systematic risk by spreading all those investments over tons of asset classes. You know, contrast that with an Enron employee that only owned Enron stock. Well, they're rolling the dice on a very, very concentrated bet on owning just all Enron. And so they both have, you know, or they have both non-systematic and systematic risk in their portfolio. So the answer is yes, you could have both. Now, why would you want both, or which is better to have in your portfolio? Those are both good questions, and they really get down to the gist of the title of what we're talking about today, which is how do the rich really get rich? Because you're like, Dominique, you've been talking to me for 10 minutes and you haven't even told me that yet. So I'm about to tell you right now. So in short, the rich own, by definition, a lot of non-systematic risk in their portfolios. And they don't own things like Enron stock, usually, but they do have very concentrated positions in their portfolio. And that is really the key. And I'm going to tell you how they step it up just a little bit more. They usually use what is called leverage to magnify their concentrated bet, which just means using other people's money to go invest. So for every dollar I put in mine of my money, I may borrow another $2, another $3, and take the leverage up two or three times. And that way, I can invest more into whatever particular asset class that I'm trying to exploit. And then when the loan comes due for the money that I borrowed, I just pay that back. But I'll have all the profits, of course. And so I can accelerate my gains by doing that type of strategy. And the rich usually do that. They leverage concentrated bets. Now, the question is, which one should you have, systematic or non-systematic? And is this risky? Should I have it in my portfolio? Blah, 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 blah. I get it. So the real question becomes, is this safe? And I would say that that is definitely a contextual question based on who's answering that question and the person doing the investing. So for instance, if you are an employee of, say, Apple, if you took on some non-systematic risk in your portfolio over the last 15 years, you've probably done pretty well. The same would go for, you know, Microsoft over the last two decades or anything like that. So those were bets that, you know, paid off for you pretty big. But if you're someone that, you know, for instance, on the other hand, I hate to use the Enron example, but, you know, if you were somebody that were investing in Enron, that probably was not the best thing for you to do, is to take all that risk in your portfolio, be it a 401k plan or not. So it really depends on what your investment goals are. What Chhabra brings out in his book is that the richest of the rich, and we'll just call that the Forbes 400 list right now, and I'm going to bring that up just so you can kind of see what we're talking about. The richest of the rich, these guys actually take very concentrated risk in things that they believe in. And I'll tell you right now, it really seems like this list, if you just break it down, of the 400 most richest people, and I have the 2016 ranking. I think he did the book on the 2014 ranking. But there's four categories of the wealthy that comprise this list. And I won't belabor this by making you guess them. But I'm just going to scroll through, and hopefully if you're on YouTube, you can see this. My screen is maximized as big as it can get. But so you got Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, Warren Buffett, Mark Zuckerberg, Larry Ellison, Michael Bloomberg, Charles and David Koch, Larry Page, and Sergey Brin. Okay, so most of you know who these people are. We got the founder of Google. We got Dixie Cup guys. We got the founder of Oracle. We got founder of Facebook. Are you noticing any trend here? Business owners, 60% of the list, as evidence or written by Ashvin in his book, are people that are business owners. So how do business owners take concentrated risk and leverage their bets? Well, when the business earns revenue and they have profits, they don't pocket those profits all the time. They reinvest a lot of them back into the business, which is by definition taking a concentrated risk. Rather than, you know, monetizing some of their business and putting it into the stock market, maybe they do some of that, but the large majority gets reinvested back into the business with the idea or the service or the product that they're, you know, selling. And that is what gets them to get these large amounts of wealth. The second, third, and fourth are the last 40%, which are financiers like Warren Buffett. And you can even argue that Warren Buffett is kind of business owner. I mean, he started a partnership way back in the day in Omaha, and then he, you know, disbanded the partnership, gave everybody their money. Then he went to go use that money to buy things like Berkshire Hathaway. So really, he was just kind of like a mogul going to buy different businesses and, you know, pulling them all into his holding company. But suffice to say, people like him, whether you want to term them as financiers or business owners, he's still taking concentrated bets on different investments, whether it be Berkshire Hathaway or American Express or Coca-Cola or any of the other type of bets that he's made over the years. The next one, the next list, and by the way, the financiers are 20% of the list. Inheritors, 12% of the list. So this takes marrying up to a whole nother level. You can look here and obviously you see the Walton family, which are, you know, second generation and probably going to be third generation wealth here of Sam Walton's kids. What we're talking about last but not least are real estate veterans that make up 8% of the list. So people like Donald Trump. That was a total faux pas. I did not mean to say Donald Trump. I meant to say Donald Trump. But people like him are on that list for their wealth. But yeah, I'm just scrolling through. This is like Carl Icahn, Ray Dalio. Those are all financier guys. Paul Allen, obviously, he's the co-founder with Bill Gates up there. You got a lot of financiers, you know, but a lot of business owners too. Elon Musk is on there. So my point in all this is saying that the rich are people that have taken concentrated bets on a specific investment strategy or even their own investment idea. And so that says a lot about how you actually accumulate wealth. Another point that Ashwin, you know, brings up in his book and kind of winding this up is that the conventional method of how we've been taught is to, you know, don't put all your eggs in one basket, is not what the wealthy have, you know, practiced in order to accumulate their wealth. They've actually done just the opposite. So you just need to take calculated risk on what you're actually investing in. And it may not be in your 401k, to be quite honest. I mean, because in most instances, that's going to be a large majority of your wealth for your retirement, and you don't want to mess that up. But you may want to start a business on the side, or if you have a business idea that you want to get off the ground, that may be something that, you know, that you use to start to generate extra income and then wealth down the line. So hopefully that's been helpful. So hopefully that has been helpful for you. If you're listening, we appreciate if you take some time to leave us a review in the iTunes store, which makes our rankings, helps our rankings rather, so that other listeners can find this podcast. Also, if you'd like for us to answer a question on the show, or you want to just drop us a line and tell us how we're doing, we'd love to hear from you. That email address is info@djh-capital.com. Again, that is info@djh-capital.com. You can find this podcast and others like it on our blog at www.djhendersonsr.com. And if you would like to learn more about our services or how we can help you solve a problem that you're having with your financial plan, you can give us a call at 214-699-7599. That's 214-699-7599. Or just schedule an appointment and reach us on the web at www.djh-capital.com. As always, have a great and prosperous day. Take care.